From the studios of PCJ Radio International, this is Focus Asia Pacific. I'm Keith Parent. Workers affected by the nuclear test in French Polynesia say they will continue to hold the French government accountable over the impact. France carried out 193 nuclear explosions between 1966 and 1966. And Sunday marked the 50th anniversary of the first test at the weekend. Lucy Smith has more.
France has promised compensation for those with poor health resulting from exposure to radiation, but little of that has been paid out. A member of the French Polynesia Assembly, Richard Tuhaeva, wants France to not only pay the victims, but to foot the bill for the healthcare costs.
The fact is, since the nuclear testing, most of the diseases was cancer, leukemia, most of the diseases was the result of the nuclear testing. So we collectively also put a request for State of France, the colonial power, to not only compensate directly the veteran, but also compensate this fund, this public healthcare fund.
Richard Tuhaeva says at first glance they have serious doubts about receiving any kind of compensation, but hopefully by bringing their case to the UN, the French government will have to bow to the pressure.
We're also raising this point in New York within the decolonization process, exposing and introducing this serious case to various embassies. It might be hard within the next few years for the colonial power to just remain silent, to believe that we will forget it.
The president of the Economic Council in Tahiti, Winky Sarge, says no one knew what was going on when France started the nuclear testing.
At that time, the military was not allowed to inform. But I can tell you that even the military didn't know what's happening. They were walking, they were fishing, they were eating the fish. They didn't know that it was not good.
He says some transparency around what really happened would bring some closure to the victims and help them move forward as a country. The president of the French Polynesian Anti-Nuclear Group, the 193 Association, Auguste Aubert Carlson, has called on people in the territory to unite over its nuclear past.
If all the French Polynesians are nuclear victims, then there is a guilty person somewhere. A system has been in place. And if we recognize this guilt, there must be fair and equitable compensation, taking into account the culture, history, and the economy of the country.
The Nuclear Workers Association's Roland Oldham says compensation is overdue and they won't back down.
The pressure is really coming on from the people. We have done a lot of peaceful demonstration and we've been too kind. They cannot carry on like that with the people. After a while, people are going to have enough of all those promises. The things are going to get more radical in the future. We cannot give up this battle. We cannot. I mean, we're doing this because it's the duty of any man anywhere in the world to do what we are doing.
Roland Oldham says they have a petition with 41,000 signatures asking for a referendum on whether reparations should be made to the region. I'm Lucy Smith.
The Nauru MP and former president, Spegnet Dadawado, says he suspects the government has intervened to stop local media from running the opposition's campaign advertising. Nauru's general election is on Saturday, and he says he has also accused the government of manipulating the police commissioner to prevent the opposition from holding a rally. He speaks next to Benjamin Robson Drawbridge.
On Thursday, we applied for a permit to gather peacefully so we could do some presentation on our visions and our plans, a political rally. The police said, that's not a problem, and we'll just go talk to our boss and get his approval. But then when you go to the police commissioner, it's just a blatant no. In my own personal belief, I think this political. I think the police commissioner is also related to the Minister for Justice, just went to him and said, these people are trying to do this thing, and I think the political gods of Nauru said no, and that was it.
In terms of your political advertising, you've been trying to run adverts?
Basically, the opposition have two advertisements that are ready to go, because, you know, we keep seeing the past month the government using the local TV and radio for advertising, they're promoting what they've been doing and what they plan to do. So we've made two advertisements to put up there. One's ready to go right now, one is almost ready. They said, all right, we'll get back to you. We have to talk to higher authorities, and we're still waiting for that. You know, there's only, what, five more days till the election now, so we're not too hopeful on that now. So it's still unfair treatment of potential candidates here between those who support government and those who don't support government.
So how then are you going to campaign if you're unable to rally or run advertising?
Well, besides visiting houses door to door, we've put up banners along the road. We've issued brochures to houses. That's probably as much as we can do. At the same time, unfortunately, with our brochures, we cannot be too critical of the government. Otherwise, we end up facing more charges from the government for it's illegal to be seen as political hatred. You know, they put that in the criminal code somewhere. So we just have to rely on letting people know our plans and our visions rather than criticize the government and their failures. One of our biggest issues was trying to tell the whole Nauru, you know, these are the failures of the government in the past 3 years, and we're scared to do that just in case then they take charges on us and might jeopardize our coming election.
Are you hopeful that the presence of the observers may enable you to campaign properly?
We're very hopeful. What the observers, when they hear, we raise our complaints to them. And we're hoping that they could advise us, you know, yes, you can go and do your campaign in this manner. We don't see any problem with that. We're looking for them to assure us that we won't face any other risk from somewhere else, where they are here to see a fair election, and hopefully they can do something about it. If not, at least they could start addressing it with the government straight away. But right now, we cannot even talk to the government ourselves. So yes, we're hopeful the observers can do more than just observe.
Guam is expected to decide within weeks whether or not to hold a referendum on the future of its political status. The island is currently a non-incorporated territory of the United States, but Guam's governor says the formal form of colonization can't go on. Radio New Zealand International's Jamie Tahanaha reports.
As a non-incorporated territory, Guam's residents, despite being US citizens, are unable to vote for president, the rights of the US Constitution don't apply, and their only delegate to Congress can't vote. No one's more aware of that fact than the island's governor, Eddie Calvo, who in a speech earlier this year pledged to try and change that.
It's time that we confronted the fact that for nearly 400 years, the state of the island had been colonial. It is the unchanged and unrepented shadow cast upon our long and unshackled destiny. Now, confidence may be the one trigger that can change that colonial state once and for all.
Mr. Calvo has established a decolonization commission, which is expected to report this month on whether to attach a plebiscite to November's election. If it goes ahead, Guamanians will select one of three options: pursue the possibility of becoming the 51st US state, free association with the US, similar to New Zealand's relationship with the Cook Islands, or full independence. The chair of the Guam Independence Task Force, Michael Lujan Bevakwa, says he's happy the time may have finally arrived to change Guam's confused status.
In a way, Guam represents a previous historical era, a time when colonialism was common, and in a way, much of the world has come to an understanding that colonialism was bad and we should eradicate it from the world, but there's still Guam where this hasn't happened.
But the path to a referendum isn't easy. Mr. Calvo's government needs to conduct a territory-wide education campaign before securing enough signatures to force a referendum. It also has to overcome a legal hurdle that requires 70% of the native Chamorro people to sign with the decolonisation registry, a task which many have said is impossible. But Robert Underwood, a former US congressman and the president of the University of Guam, says while it's difficult to work out how to include Chamorro people in the process, it's imperative that they have a key say.
When you have a colony, how do you decolonize it? Do you include everybody who showed up because they are a colony? Or do you try to sort out who are the people who really have primary claim? And so in the case of Guam, I think the case is pretty clear that it is the Chamorro people who have primary claim over this process.
Dr. Underwood says that in any case, a vote would only be the start of a very drawn-out process, as the ultimate decision on Guam's future rests with Congress. Statehood would require the support of the other 50 states, and he says it's unlikely that states like California, with a population of close to 40 million, would support Guam, with 160,000 people, having just as many senators in Washington. And with Guam's strategic importance to the US in its pivot to Asia, where the Pentagon plans to spend close to $10 billion upgrading Air Force, Navy and Marines bases, Washington is unlikely to let go easily. Michael Lujan Bevacqua says a vote would only be the start of a very long battle.
That's why we can't simply look at this as kind of like a vote alone, but it has to be part of like a larger struggle. And so the United States has been very clear that whatever we vote on, it is not binding to them. And so it's really going to be up to us then to submit it to them, try to work with them.
Whether people support severing or tightening ties with the US, all camps on Guam agree that its current political status is unfair and undemocratic. This is Jamie Tahana.
The mining giant Rio Tinto has handed its majority shareholding in Bougainville Copper Limited to a trust, which will distribute the shares to the Bougainville and PNG governments. This has prompted an angry reaction from Bougainville's president, John Mormis. He says all of the 53.8% shareholding in the company, which has produced any copper or gold in nearly 30 years, should go to the autonomous Bougainville government. Mr. Momus told Don Wiseman that Rio Tinto made the decision with no consultation and has walked away from its responsibility for the damage caused by the mine.
Rio Tinto made their decision in London and they only came to tell us. There was no consultation whatsoever. We tried to get them to understand our position and based on that make the necessary changes, but they would not budge. So and they've also walked away without addressing the legacy issues. The mine, as you know, caused a lot of damage, environmental damage, destruction to village life. In fact, this was the root cause of the crisis. And Rio Tinto just refuses to accept responsibility to compensate the people and to pay for the damage that they caused.
So what will happen now with regard to that? If the ABG is a major shareholder, does that mean you're effectively absorbing that debt, that legacy debt?
That would be correct, yes. If we became the major shareholder, we would absorb that. I guess we would have no option but to deal with the legacy issues. But we are considering getting legal advice to sue Rio Tinto for their refusal to address the legacy issues. Namely the damage and the deprivation of normal life, destruction of villages and so on around the mine.
When you raise these legacy issues with Rio Tinto, what do they say? Clearly they've ignored them all, but what do they say to you during conferences?
They said that they operated the mine according to the then laws of the country. One, that's they operate the mine, they didn't break any rules. The mining law of Papua New Guinea at the time allowed them to do what they did. And secondly, they were forced to leave, implying that the crisis, the destruction caused to the mine by the rebels, forced them to leave. So therefore, they don't see any reason why they should be compensating us and paying for the damage done. But I told them because of the totally unjust operation of the mine in Bougainville, although it was allowed by the law then, now everybody knows it was totally unjust. People of Bougainville got very little out of it. Rio Tinto made billions. Japanese government made millions and millions. And the least beneficiaries were the people of Bougainville and the landowners. And then the new mining policies, which were developed post-crisis, as they learned from Bougainville, actually tell us that what we are telling them is true and they still refuse to accept responsibility.
One of the critical things that your government faces, and you've mentioned this to us on a number of occasions, is the need for major foreign investors. Now that there effectively is not a major foreign investor in this big mining company that you've been hoping may come back under new terms, what chance is there of the Panguna mine ever reopening, do you think?
When Rio Tinto moves out, you still have Bougainville Copper, which is the mining company in which Rio Tinto had the majority shareholding. That company, we are trying to take control of it by asking that we be given the controlling interest. And, of course, we will invite, if we are in that position, we will invite a developer, investor come and work with us. There are a number of big mining companies which are very interested. We've been contacted by them. We know. And we want to make the best out of this. We want to get a positive out of this disastrous situation that Rio Tinto has created by refusing to accept responsibility for the environmental damage, for the impoverishment of the people, by not accepting the responsibility to distribute benefits according to the best regimes of justice and sharing of benefits.
Now, with the national government now still having quite a substantial part of Bougainville Copper, what sort of discussions are you planning with them about the unevenness of all of this?
Under the current arrangement, the national government and ABG would have equal shares, right? The rest of the shares are owned by individuals. We don't want the national government to have equal shares with us. They have benefited from the mine, and we believe that it's not acceptable to the people of Bougainville unless the people of Bougainville, through their government, has a controlling interest. And that is what we are going to discuss with the Prime Minister. You know, the current situation is totally unacceptable, but I believe if the national government, because they didn't pay for the shares given to them or given free, if they gave us majority shareholding, then the people of Bougainville would be very happy because this is what they've been fighting for. At least they would now feel they're in a position under our own mining law to accept the responsibility to deal with other related issues such as legacy issues, and people will be more than willing to discuss with developers and other investors to reopen the mine. You know, if you want to solve the Bougainville crisis, this is the way to solve it. We're offering the national government an opportunity, which is also consistent with the peace agreement. You know, the peace agreement is a joint agreement between the national government and ABG. By implementing the peace agreement jointly, we will solve the Bougainville crisis. What we are now proposing is also consistent to this agreement. If they refuse, then our law will not allow them to operate in Bougainville. So you'll have a dead company, a company that has the access to the data, but they will not be allowed to operate in Bougainville under our new mining law.
Why is that?
If BCL decides to sell 25% of its shares to another group, then by our law, they will not be allowed to operate in Bougainville.
And if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. The author of a new book which documents traditional methods of growing yam says the book has preserved indigenous crop planting knowledge valuable to farmers in the Pacific region. The book, called Tokago ko Muisekamanga, has been published in the Tongan language and was recently launched in Auckland by the author Sinon Tahiti. Mr. Tahiti based the book on the experience of the late Keto Tofu, who was an award-winning crop farmer in Tonga. He spoke to Indira Stewart.
Tonga is part of the Pacific region. It's, you know, a repository of knowledge that has stood the test of time. And the opportunity for me to record the story of this great farmer from Tonga, you know, is a blessing for me. The fact that many of our ancestors have gone to the next life without having their knowledge shared. So it's important that we document the knowledge of those who have come before us so that we learn from that.
Can you talk a little bit about Kite Ao Te Tafu, whose experience, who shared his experience with you in the book, inspired much of what's in the book? Can you tell us a little bit about perhaps the legacy he left in terms of farming?
So he was very scientific and systematic to his approach. So he experimented, say, with how to grow the seedlings. He experimented with how and when to prepare the land and to grow the yams using the phases of the moon. And that's a traditional form of knowledge. He experimented with which land in which the yam will grow best. And all of those aspects of yam farming, you know, as an evidence, he, for some 30 years, has been the first prize winner of yam farming at the Tonga Tapu Agricultural Show.
That's amazing. What would you say about how valuable that knowledge still is in terms of planting crops in a time where we've got more developed technology and perhaps more modern practices? Would you say that that's still very relevant?
Still very relevant, not just because of its historical importance, but also what we can learn from the past and helping us to navigate our way into the future. One of the significant points about Kitao's methodology is that it is very organic and very eco-friendly. Most of the devices and ways that he employed to farm yam are very much in line with the principles of living harmoniously with nature.
Through interviewing Kitao, you found out that yam was one of the fastest food crops to plant. What's the turnaround time in between planting and harvesting?
Normally, it takes a few months. So what Kitao has actually improved on was actually an existing form of planting of yams, where you plant the first crop in April and May, and then you harvest it in December. But instead of harvesting the whole crop, you actually cut off the head of the yam and leave that in the soil. In 2 months' time, you go back and you will find that you'll have at least three or four big yams, same size as the first one you harvested, you know, early in December. So in essence, you're actually harvesting the same yam twice. In terms of the effort of time and land preparation, you're actually saving a lot, but you're reaping a lot from yam growing.
The Vanuatu Meteorological Service says that its new cyclone map will help people understand cyclones better and help them get ready. The new tracking maps use numbers and the alphabet instead of longitude and latitude. That includes drawings of the potential impact of cyclones. The service's William Woer explained to Lucy Smith how the maps could make a difference.
Basically, to simplify latitudes and longitudes with respect to the island. So whenever there is a cyclone, we at the Met Service, we locate the cyclones, and with the tracking map, we make it a little bit simpler to just refer to the coordinates as a letter and a number instead of having a full longitude.
What's different from these tracking maps to the ones that you had previously?
The difference at the moment is now we have included the impact classifications or the land conditions and the sea conditions as well. What we have also included is the categories or the wind categories we have now allocated with respect to Cat 1 or Cat 2 or Cat 3, Cat 4, Cat 5 cyclones.
So if people don't have the map, will they be slightly disadvantaged in cyclone season?
Definitely yes. But I mean, there's this new one. All that we have included is some extra new informations into it. The map itself is not. There is nothing apart from just cleaning it up, extending the area a bit. But there has been a lot of previous map. And with this version, there is no big change to it, so they can still be using that old version. With regards to this the cyclone tracking map, it has a little bit more information. I think what we're trying to tell people is to take precautions, you know, more time in preparing than wait till the last minute. So that's something that we wanted and we're encouraging our communities to do. Instead of waiting until the winds are starting to affect them, they need to take actions well beforehand.
The expanded Oceania Championships Leagues has been given the thumbs up by small football clubs in the Pacific. A record 16 teams will compete in Oceania's revamped Premier Club competition, while more home matches in the islands are also on the cards. Vinnie Wiley reports.
Vanuatu champions Amical FC have previously criticised the US $7,000 entry fee imposed on teams and the decision to play the tournament in one central location, denying clubs the chance to play at home and boost revenue. From next year, a record 16 teams will take part in the group stage, and four groups being contested at four different venues, with the semis and final to be played home and away. Amical's technical director, Anthony Pisano, says the chance to play in front of their home supporters is well overdue.
That's something that we've been pushing for the last couple of years, because it's very important that we're able to give something back to our fans and our sponsors and have the opportunity to generate revenue. And the O-League has a lot of interest here in Vanuatu, and this move gives us a lot of good marketing opportunities, especially if we're able to host games locally here.
Solomon Islands, Tahiti and Vanuatu will each get a second team in the main draw from next season, joining Fiji, New Caledonia, New Zealand and Papua New Guinea. The Deputy Chief Executive of the Solomon Islands Football Federation, Joseph Bosso, says it's an exciting step forward for local clubs, but also a challenge.
I think overall it will really boost the local league, give more momentum for the competition, because there are now two spots to fight for. So I think it's great news for us. But at the same time, it also indicates that we have to really work hard to make sure that the clubs that qualify from Solomon Islands do have the capacity to not only participate, but be the top competitive clubs in the competition.
For the first time, the top two teams from the preliminary competition will also take part. This involves the National League champions of American Samoa, Cook Islands, Samoa and Tonga. Cook Islands champions Tupapa Mararenga finished one step shy of the main draw in three of the past four seasons. Club president John Paul Wilson says the change offers that little bit more incentive.
It's just full on. You have to play three games in 1 week, which is huge. I think only in Oceania that does that. But apart from that, it just have to make sure that we just prepare well for this one. At least now we know that first, second will go through to the next stage. It gives us something to look at forward to instead of just only one from the first round to go through. At least it gives another team from the bottom four to actually go and experience what is it like.
Amid all the changes, the prize remains the same. Auckland City won their sixth consecutive OFC Champions League crown in April and will represent the region at December's FIFA Club World Cup in Japan.
And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. If you have any comments or questions, we'd love to hear from you. You can always contact us by email, which is focus@pcjmedia.com. Also, let us know how you heard the program, either on shortwave to the Pacific, satellite to every other region, or through one of our partner stations in the United States, Canada, Europe, Asia Pacific regions on medium wave or FM. And by the way, if you have heard the program on shortwave, do give us some program details and we can send you a Focus Asia Pacific QSL card. Next week and the week after, we're taking a small vacation, so we will be bringing you the best of Focus Asia Pacific for the next 2 weeks. And that's for the version of the program you're listening to now, which is the weekly 30-minute edition. The daily, three-time daily, that is, 15-minute program will go ahead as normal. So until next time, friends, I'm Keith Palomo wishing you well, saying so long, take care. We'll see you again very soon. Bye-bye.